Okay, Jeremiah chapter 40. And chapter 40 through 44, we're actually going to kind of pick up here and go through chapter 40 through 44 because it kind of flows together. This is after the fall of Jerusalem. Jeremiah is going to be set free. We're introducing Gedaliah, who's a player already, but really hasn't taken a prominent place in the book of Jeremiah. And then they're going to end up going through a series of events in just a matter of a few months, and they're going to end up in Egypt with Jeremiah. And that's chapter 40 through 44. And then we're going to finish that, then we're going to go back and do the last chapter. If you look in chapter 52, there you have, again, the whole chapter, the fall of Jerusalem. And this chapter is the same thing as how the book of 2 Chronicles ends, as far as the fall of Jerusalem and then how they go off. And so we're going to end with that, and then from there we'll go to the book of Lamentations. So we're going to kind of, we've had the fall of Jerusalem. In a sense, we really should go read chapter 52 right now and then go to Lamentations and then come back and do these verses, these chapters, you understand? But we're going to kind of, chapter 52 takes place here. Lamentations is written right here. And then these things happen. So we're going to do a little bit. We're going to kind of break our chronological flow to kind of finish this story. So here we are, chapter 40 of Jeremiah. The year is 586. It is July. July is when Jerusalem fell. So chapter 40 and the city is Ramah. I've given you a map. Jeremiah is at Ramah, and he's in the chains. If we draw a map very quickly, Dead Sea, Galilee, here's Jerusalem, here's Gibeon right up in here. The high place of Geba would be right here. A lot of us were there this summer standing here. We see Jerusalem a couple miles away. Going to the north, you can look down, you can see the city of Geba. Then north of that is the city on your maps. You can see the city of Ramah is from our Mitzpah is right here. And Mitzpah is going to play in this story here, is right here. That's going to be a headquarters. Up here is going to be Shechem, Shiloh. Shechem is right here. Mount Ebal, Mount Gerizim is right here. And this is Geba, the high place of Geba, or the where Saul was anointed and Solomon had the vision. It used to be a high place of worship. And this is Gibeon right here. Gibeon right there. Okay. So here we go. The word of the Lord came to Jeremiah from the word came to Jeremiah from the Lord after Nebuzaradan, commander of the imperial guard, had released him at Ramah. And Ramah would be right here north of Gibeon. Right in here would be Ramah. Ramah was a holding place for the prisoners that were captured. A lot of people were dead in the streets, but now a lot of they go up into here, and it's a waiting place because from here they'd make their journey up into the Megiddo Valley, and then from there they'd hit the road and head on into Babylon. So this was a holding place. They're just before they set off on their death march to Babylon. And Jeremiah somehow had been found in chains. Remember, he was released. They sent him to release him from the prison, the courtyard of the king. He was released. But it appears that in the commotion, he got arrested again. There's no explanation for it other than, because it's very clear he's released. So go set him free. They found him and set him free, put him in Gedaliah's care. But then what ends up taking place is he's back in chains again. So it assumed that in the, and you got to imagine the commotion. I mean, there's no police force. There's no defense of Israel left. It's just a matter of Babylonian troops going over the city. Nebuzaradan has got direct orders from Nebuchadnezzar to find Jeremiah. They want him. Why do they want him? One, he was saying positive things about Babylon and Nebuchadnezzar. Two, he's a prophet. And again, I said last week, they're not necessarily just narrow-minded that they're only following Nebo, their god, or Marduk, their Babylonian god. They're open to all kinds of deities. And clearly, Jeremiah's got a connection to the spiritual realm because, one, he prophesied accurately, and two, he wasn't afraid to speak. In the face of death, he wasn't afraid to speak. So he's convinced of what he's doing. He's a valuable commodity, a prophet who has spiritual insight, who will speak the truth. Nebuchadnezzar wants that kind of a guy. So, but then somehow in the commotion, he gets back in the chains here. So anyway, Nebuzaradan, commander of the imperial guard, had released him at Ramah. He had found Jeremiah bound in chains among the captives from Jerusalem and Judah who were being carried into exile to Babylon. When the commander of the guard found Jeremiah, he said to him, "The Lord your God," now this, the guy speaking here, this is a quote from Nebuzaradan, the imperial commander of Nebuchadnezzar. He's Nebuchadnezzar's number one man. And here's a quote. And again, remember, it's a quote spoken to Jeremiah in Jeremiah's book. So this would be, if you accept the authorship of the book, this would be a first-hand quote. This isn't somebody quoting somebody who said somebody said something. This is Jeremiah hearing for himself what Nebuchadnezzar says to him. The Lord your God decreed this disaster for this place. And now the Lord has brought it about. He has done just as he said he would. All this happened because you people sinned against the Lord and did not obey him. But today I am freeing you from the chains on your wrist. Come with me to Babylon, if you like, and I will look after you. Now, that Jeremiah is being invited. He's not going to go on the death march with everybody else. The chains are coming off. You're going to get a ride in one of the limousines heading back to the land, heading back home, and we'll take care of you. You'll come as a royal guest to Babylon. And you wonder how much of this is influenced because of a guy named Daniel already in royal care in the palace. But you're free. Notice how free they let him be. But if you do not want to, then don't come. Look, the whole country lies before you. Go wherever you please. In other words, Jeremiah is being given a passport to the world. Where do you want to go? You can come back to Babylon and we'll take care of you. Or you can stay here and the land is wide open to you. Wherever you want to go. However, before Jeremiah turned to go, Nebuzaradan added, go back to Gedaliah. That's who he'd been released to originally. Son of Ahikam, the son of Shaphan, whom the king of Babylon has appointed over the towns of Judah. Now again, we mentioned these names last week. It came up last week in chapter 40 or 39. Gedaliah is the son of Ahikam. And Ahikam was someone like earlier in the book had provided protection for Jeremiah, had some kind of access to the priests and the scribes and the royalty there, and he protected Jeremiah. And his father, Shaphan, was one of them who was in the temple, who was around when the scroll was found in Josiah's day. So this is three generations of players in the political kingdom. And it is apparently they have found some inscriptions. When we talk about the ostracons that were found, that's pottery with broken piece of pottery with notes written on them. They're like the emails or the stickum notes. They found one at Lachish with Gedaliah's name on it as one of the leaders of the land, the ruler of the land. Not in the sense that he was the king, but he was in a position under the king overseeing certain parts of Zedekiah's kingdom. So from that, now that's not biblical, but it is Gedaliah, and he's got a very strong heritage there as far as his father and his grandfather. And so it appears, and Nebuchadnezzar didn't just grab some guy and say, you be the leader. It appears that Gedaliah, from that ostracon, was one of the leaders, one of the chief men of Zedekiah's kingdom of Judah. And so when everybody else is taken captive and killed, it appears they turn things over to one of the men on the staff of Zedekiah himself. So Gedaliah. And that's who he'd been released to. So Jeremiah is released to Gedaliah into a family that has already provided him protection earlier in the book, to a family who was already with Josiah when the scroll was found, and to a family who's already been part of the leadership of the land under Zedekiah. So it would all tie together. Go back to Gedaliah, son of Ahikam, the son of Shaphan, whom the king of Babylon has appointed over the towns of Judah, and live with him among the people, or go anywhere else you please. So he says, you can go with us back to Babylon. You can go back and stay with Gedaliah. If that doesn't make you happy, then go wherever you want to go. Then the commander gave him provisions and a present and let him go. So all the people he prophesied to that had rejected him and mocked him are going off into captivity or dead in the street, Jeremiah stands up out of the chains, is given gifts and some money, and they wave goodbye to him. He's given a Babylonian escort out of the prison camp, and they watch him walk away. Kind of a good confirmation, everybody in chains, maybe we should have listened to him. So, and again, everything he said came to pass. So Jeremiah went to Gedaliah, son of Ahikam, at Mizpah, and that's right here. Mizpah, right up in here, is where he goes. He goes from there up here. This is going to become the headquarters. Mizpah is going to become the headquarters now. It's like the New Jerusalem or the New Samaria. Samaria was the capital of Israel. Jerusalem is the capital here. This now becomes the headquarters of Gedaliah's new administration. Now, it's not going to become a big deal, and it's not going to become a great city, but that's the local headquarters right now at Mizpah. and stayed with him among the people who were left behind in the land. And so this is where everybody kind of begins to surround them, or that they kind of begin to circle around here. That becomes kind of headquarters. Remember, Jerusalem, it's been the site of a two-year siege. So most likely all the trees are ripped down, used for battering rams, used for fuel. The place has been burnt. It's been ravaged. There's dead bodies all over. No one's going to come back and bury them. If they do, they're just corpses everywhere. So this place is trashed, at least for, you know, quite some time. So they're moved north. Okay, verse 7. When this takes place, that is debated. I think it takes place, the next year. We're going to start talking about, it's July right now. We're going to start talking about September, October, into this part. I think it's all the same year, 586. Some people will at least, and I'll suggest that there may be a year or two break right here. But I think this moves straight. It feels to me it just moves right on into the very next month. When all the army officers and their men who were still in the open country heard that the king of Babylon had appointed Gedaliah, son of Ahikam, as governor over the land and had put him in charge of the men, women, and children who were the poorest in the land and who had not been carried into exile to Babylon, they came to Gedaliah at Mizpah. Here's the guy's name. Ishbel, son of Nethaniah, Jehonan, and Jonathan, sons of Kareah, Sharia, son of Tanhumeth, the sons of Ephaiah, the Netophathite, and Jasaniah, the son of Maacathite, and their men, Gedaliah, son of Ahikam, son of Shaphan, took an oath to reassure them and their men. Do not be afraid to serve the Babylonians, he says. Settle down in the land and serve the king of Babylon, and it will go well with you. He says, okay, listen, we've got a commitment from Babylon. We've got a commitment from Nebuchadnezzar. He's not coming back to destroy it. We're done. The battle is won. So I take an oath. I swear to you, we are fine. We can function here. We can rebuild here. We are now in the Babylonian Empire. And that's where we are now, part of the Babylonian Empire. Just like God said, just like Jeremiah said, this is it. We've been absorbed into, we have fallen. Everything will be fine if we cooperate with Nebuchadnezzar. I myself will stay at Mizpah to represent you before the Babylonians. So if we have a need, if we need new roads, if we need some kind of tax relief, if we need some kind of provisions for food, I will represent us to Babylon. I've been appointed by Nebuchadnezzar. I have Nebuchadnezzar's ear. You work with me. We have favor. To represent you before the Babylonians who come to us, but you are to harvest the wine, the summer fruit, and oil. Now, there again, I think, is important. Because the beginning in July, the grapes and the olives and the figs and the dates, all the fruits would begin to be harvested. First, you'd have the harvest of the grapes, and then the next would be the olives and the figs. That's all taking place. So as Jerusalem is falling, they're just getting ready for the big harvest of the grapes and the dates and the figs. So he says, but you are to harvest the wine, the summer fruit and oil, and put them in your storage jars and live in the towns you have taken over. And notice right there, who planted these vineyards? Who's been taking care of these trees? Many of the people that have gone into exile. But he tells these people now, because this is Babylonian territory and I'm in charge of it, you're coming to me, go out and start harvesting. This is our land now. It's the poor people now control what's left. And so the poor people have the vineyards. The poor people have the olive tree, the olive groves. When all the Jews in Moab, Ammon, and Edom, and all the other countries heard that the king of Babylon had left a remnant in Judah and had appointed Gedaliah, son of Ahikam, son of Shaphan, as governor over them, they all came back to the land of Judah to Gedaliah at Mizpah from all the countries where they had been scattered. And they harvested an abundance of wine and summer fruit. So here's the story right here. If you've got these, it's the harvest season. This land has been overrun. There's not enough people probably to manage it because most of the people are gone or dead, but there are some people here. People from Ammon, Moab, and Edom, they come up and help with the harvest. Now, yeah, right. You know, they're not helping and leaving, they're helping and taking. But it's a free-for-all in a sense. They came back and harvested an abundance of wine and summer fruit and probably take it home. And they begin to realize, listen, This could be a great addition for Ammon, Moab, or Edom. And remember, the book of Obadiah is against, it is against the Edomites by the prophet Obadiah, because the Edomites were cheering for the Babylonians for this very advantage. The Edomites got in trouble, and God promised them in the book of Obadiah, you're done, because you came against my people and cheered for the Babylonians, wanting their downfall so you could extend your borders and take their land. You're done. You're going to be written out of history. He said, I will bring these people back, but Edomites, you're done. And that's part of what's playing in here. These people are looking at this land like, hey, so we'll just take this. The Jews are done. The people of God are gone. We'll occupy their land. Now, you can see how, if this is indeed God's land and He has given it to a chosen people and they're being disciplined, you can see that that might be a bad idea to think you're going to take that land as your own and then the Jews are never going to come back. Kind of maybe, you can kind of see a little bit of current history in that right now. If indeed the Jews have come back and things are taken, there's some people there that want to say it's their land, and there may be a little bit of a conflict there that matches this. But nonetheless, we read on. Verse 13, Johanan, son of Kareah, and all the army of officers still in the open country came to Gedaliah at Mizpah and said to him, don't you know that Balas, king of the Ammonites, over here. Now, this is interesting. This is the only name, this is the only place this name pops up anywhere, is right here. Balas, the king of the Ammonites. Except, I think it was 1984. Guess what they found? They found a seal with his name on it. From this time period, from right around 600 BC, Balas, king of the Ammonites, they found this. If you have a study Bible, it's probably in your footnotes. So this guy's name right here has been confirmed with a seal found right here in the land of Ammon, which is pretty neat, which is Jordan today. So this name has been confirmed, right place, right time, right position. They say, don't you know that Balas, king of the Ammonites, has sent Ishmael, son of Nethaniah, to take your life? You just welcomed him into your city. You just welcomed him into your little kingdom. Says, go out and help us with the harvest. He has been sent by the king to kill you. He's just trying to get on your side to find an opportune time to kill you. So, there's just warning. But Gedaliah, son of Ahikam, did not believe them. I've talked to the man. The man's a good man. I've looked in his eye. I can tell that he's a good, honest man. I am not afraid of him. God has put me in position or whatever. Gedaliah is not afraid of Ishmael. Then Johanan, son of Kareah, said privately to Gedaliah in Mizpah, let me go and, listen, I'll do you a favor. Let me go and kill Ishmael, son of Nethaniah, and no one will know. I am your assassin. I'll move in the shadows. I'll knock him off, and no one will know the difference. And then this threat is gone. Why should he take your life and cause all the Jews who are gathered around you to be scattered and the remnant of Judah to perish? So in other words, we've got a good thing going here. If they assassinate you, you're Nebuchadnezzar. It's not that Gedaliah is so special, although he's probably got some great leadership skills. He is important because Nebuchadnezzar has appointed him. Nebuchadnezzar is the man, and Gedaliah is his chosen leader. And so everything's working like a well-oiled machine because he's got Babylonian support. So they don't want to lose this man. So they say, it'd be better to knock off Ishmael than to have Ishmael knock you off. Because when you go, well, now Nebuchadnezzar's going to be upset, and we're going to have some kind of a conflict once again. Let me go and kill Ishmael. Verse 16, but Gedaliah, son of Ahikam, said to Johanan, son of Kareah, don't do such a thing. What you are saying about Ishmael is not true. Chapter 41. In the seventh month, September, October, see, July had the month, but this was July, August, September, harvest. They came in, they've done the harvest. Now the harvest is done. In the seventh month, Ishmael, son of Nethaniah, son of Elishama, who was of royal blood and had been one of the king's officers, came with 10 men to Gedaliah, son of Ahikam, at Mizpah. He brings 10 men in, and there's some royal blood involved in this, meaning maybe he's thinking maybe he could have part of it. Maybe he should be the one. Maybe Balas is going to set him up as the king over here, whatever. Well, they were eating together there, so he's having a meal with Ishmael, son of Nethaniah, and the 10 men who were with him got up and struck down Gedaliah, son of Ahikam, son of Shaphan, with the sword, killing the one whom the king of Babylon had appointed as governor over the land. Ishmael also killed all the Jews who were with Gedaliah at Mizpah, as well as the Babylonian soldiers who were there. Not a good idea. You're killing Babylonian soldiers. See, they had Babylonian support, so there's Babylonians there overseeing and protecting them with, you know, the support of Nebuchadnezzar. And now they just got slaughtered. Almost like, it sounds a little bit like the Maccabean revolt a little bit, except on the negative side. Now Gedaliah's dead. The Babylonian soldiers are dead, and the leadership now has been lost. Okay. Verse 4, the day after Gedaliah's assassination, before anyone knew about it, so Gedaliah's dead, you know, it's not on, you know, news flashes. No one knows that he's dead yet. They got rid of the body, shut the door, everything's covered up. 80 men, now watch this, this is interesting also. 80 men who had shaved off their beards, torn their clothes, and cut themselves came from Shechem, Shiloh, and Samaria. From Shechem, in between Mount Ebal and Gerizim, Shiloh, where the tabernacle used to sit back in Joshua's day, and Samaria, further north, these guys, 80 men, came. And what can do, you know what? Listen to look at their. They've got their beards shaved, their clothes are torn, and they've cut themselves. Now, the cutting of themselves is a pagan practice, but combined with everything else, what are those signs of? Those are signs of mourning. They're in some kind of mourning. They are not necessarily scripturally correct, but they are in their attitude correct. They are in mourning for probably the disaster that has fallen. In the midst of this harvest, they're going to take a break, and they are in mourning. And they're heading from Shechem, Shiloh, Samaria, the old Israelite territory, the northern 10 tribes, and they're heading down towards the Lord's temple. Now again, there's no temple there. It's burnt, it's gone, but they're going down with part of the grain. They're going down as with an offering, like they probably have done for years. They're coming down to offer to the Lord. Now, there's been no animal sacrifices after this until, you know, it was reestablished, but they could still have grain offerings where they could bring grain, they could bring in some kind of provisions, they could offer them, pour them out or whatever, here on the Temple Mount. And these 80 men are passing by Mizpah, passing by Gedaliah's headquarters on their way to the Lord's temple. Here we go, we're reading this again. The day after Gedaliah's assassination, before anyone knew about it, 80 men who had shaved off their beards, torn their clothes, cut themselves, came from Shechem, Shiloh, and Samaria, bringing grain offerings and incense with them to the house of the Lord. Again, I think that means Jerusalem, the Temple Mount. It's not there anymore, but it is still the house of the Lord, what's left of it. I'm going to stop right here real quick. Don't lose our place. We're in verse 5. Now, do you remember, I talked about the beams. I talked about the 42-foot beams that were found on the Temple Mount just recently, and they've been carbon dated and tested, and they date back to possibly this temple right here, Solomon's temple. They're 3,000 years old or right around that time period, and some of them are probably from Herod's temple. So remember, when this thing was burnt, there would probably be, you know, it wouldn't necessarily burn completely to the ground. There'd be stuff that'd be removed. And it appears that some of these cedars of Lebanon had been pulled out and the beams reused again. Some of them are in the Al-Aqsa Mosque in the ceiling. Now, they're 42 foot all the way across. And they've been there. They've got signs, carbon dating, a variety of... I mean, it's pretty clear. Some of them date back to the time of Solomon's temple. If they were used in the temple or not, they are probably on that Temple Mount. Some of them are clearly from Herod's temple. It's just so you know. It's interesting. They're, at the same time, if you Google that up and look at that... some of them have been being burnt now. Now that there's been burning going on, someone's burning them on the Temple Mount. Now you can put the two and two together and figure this out too. And there's been some complaints because they're burning ancient timber and they're trying to keep it covered up. It's any kind of a sign of any kind of a sign that Solomon's temple has been found. There's groups on the Temple Mount that will go about and try to cover it up because they don't believe Solomon ever existed. His temple never existed. Herod's temple never existed. It's all a fabrication. So any kind of evidence, archaeological proof, they destroy. But anyway, the reason I say that, because these guys are coming down to the smoldering remains, and some of those timber may be, you know, hanging off of what's left of the building or something. So, in a sense, the Lord's house, it's still there per se, but it's trash. It's been smoked. But anyway, they come down. They're on the way to the Lord's house. Verse 6. Ishmael, son of Nethaniah, went out from Mizpah to meet them. There's 80 men approaching the city of Mizpah. Again, it's not a huge city. It's more like a camp area. I mean, it's a city, but it's not glorious or anything. So he goes off and realizes 80 men coming into the city are going to want to see Gedaliah. This could cause some problems. When he met them, he says, "Come to Gedaliah, son of Ahikam." So, oh yes, that's why we're passing by. We'd love to say hello and pay our respects to Gedaliah, the leader of the land. When they went into the city, Ishmael, son of Nethaniah, and the men who were with him slaughtered them and threw them into a cistern. But 10 of them who were thinking said to Ishmael, "Don't kill us, don't kill us. We have wheat and barley, oil and honey, hidden in a field somewhere. Don't kill us because our secret will die with us. We'll tell you where we've got the oil hidden and the wine, please." Oh, okay, so they're bargaining for their lives. So he let them alone and did not kill them with the others. Now the cistern where he threw all the bodies of the men he had killed along with Gedaliah, now you know what happened to him, was the one King Asa had made as part of the defense against Baasa, king of Israel. Ishmael, son of Nethaniah, filled it with the dead. Now there's going to be right here, if you remember the story of David, if you remember when David became king, and there was a struggle between General Joab of Judah and General Abner of King Solomon's line. Do you remember the other two generals? And they're going to meet at the great pool of Gibeon right here. It was a huge pool, and they're going to, just like they did with Goliath, they're going to have a duel. They're going to be ready to fight. They say, "Hey, let's just have some of the young men have a duel." It was kind of popular. Several times in the book of 1 Samuel, you can go back when you read about David's mighty men, how many times there was a duel. When you read about the mighty men, two men came and fought. Like one man fought the tall Egyptian. One man fought, you know, the brother of Goliath. Here, Joab and Abner, it appears it was part of the Greek culture that had kind of come in with the Philistines and had trickled up into their military outlook. As when you're going to have a military battle, let's just have a duel. And it was kind of the way it came out of the Greek culture, apparently. That's where Goliath's duel with David came from. Well, anyway, they're going to, right around the, there's a deep pool there, and they had some men get up, and they all grabbed each other, and they all just stabbed each other, and they all dropped dead. And it wasn't a good day at all for the duel because no one won the battle. But the whole point I'm saying that for, there's a deep pool there. It's mentioned here, and there is today. You can go there, and there's a huge well. It's a deep hole. It's a cistern of sorts with stairs going all the way down. It appears to be that pool that they're talking about. It's the same location right here. You can still see it. Okay. We are in chapter 41, verse 9. Now the cistern where he threw all the bodies of the men he had killed along with Gedaliah was the one King Asa had made as part of the defense against Baasa, king of Israel. Ishmael, son of Nethaniah, filled it with the dead. It's this pool. He could have built it up and helped with the defense so they had water there. Verse 10, Ishmael made captives of all the rest of the people who were in Mizpah. So maybe things got out of hand right here. When he goes back, he takes captive the whole city. The king's daughters, along with all the others who were left there. Now again, who are the king's daughters? This would be Zedekiah's daughters. And it could be his daughters, maybe from a harem of some sort, or they could be just royal people, the royal women that were associated with what was left over. Not everyone was taken, apparently. Some of the royal daughters or the royal women were there in Mizpah with Gedaliah. They were taken, along with all the others who were left there, over whom Nebuzaradan, commander of the imperial guard, had appointed Gedaliah, son of Ahikam. Ishmael, son of Nethaniah, took them captive and set out to cross over to the Ammonites. So he's going to take all these people captive and set out to go to the Ammonites, go back to King Baalis, just like he was told. That's where the problem's coming from. When Johan, son of Kareah, and all the army officers who were with him heard about all the crimes Ishmael, son of Nethaniah, had committed, they took all their men and went to fight Ishmael, son of Nethaniah. They caught up with him near the great pool at Gibeon. Again, right here. So again, are we talking about where he dumped the bodies? Maybe that's another pool, but now we are at the great pool. Now he's fleeing, probably down this way to get across over here. They caught him at the great pool of Gibeon. When all the people Ishmael had with him saw Johanan, son of Kareah, and the army officers who were with him, they were glad. Of course they're glad. Here comes our rescue mission. All the people Ishmael had taken captive at Mizpah turned and went over to Johanan, son of Kareah. But Ishmael, son of Nethaniah, and the eight of his men escaped from Johanan and fled to the Ammonites. They made their run down here through Jericho, crossed the Jordan, and they got out. But these people were saved. But now you've got a problem. The assassin is left. The military, what's left of them, knows about it. They've got, they're going to step up security, but Gedaliah's dead. And we're lost again. So here we go. Then Johanan, son of Kareah, I'm in verse 16, and all the army of officers who were with him led away all the survivors from Mizpah, who he had recovered from Ishmael, son of Nethaniah, after he had assassinated Gedaliah, son of Ahikam. The soldiers, the women, the children, the court officials he had brought from Gibeon, and they went on stopping at Gareth-Kimham. Now right here, Bethlehem is right here, the city of Bethlehem, where the baby was born, right here. There's a stopping point right there. That's what that's referring to. We're not sure where it's at. It's probably nothing more than a quick trip. It's a stopping point, it appears. And they're heading where? They're heading to Egypt. Because they're scared. They realize, how are we going to explain this? The guy's been killed. Gedaliah's been killed. They're going to get out before there's a revenge coming from the Ammonites or from Babylon. Let's just get out of this land. Okay, verse 17. And they went on, stopping at Gareth-Kimham near Bethlehem on their way to Egypt to escape the Babylonians. See, they're afraid the Babylonians are going to make a play here. They were afraid of them because Ishmael son of Nethaniah had killed Gedaliah son of Ahikam, whom the king of Babylon had appointed as governor over the land. And now, who's going to be able to tell the story straight? Meaning, it's like, well, we weren't part of it. Who's going to believe you? Who's here? Who's the witnesses? I mean, we're as guilty as they are in the eyes of Nebuchadnezzar. The story's never going to be told right. Then all the army of officers, including Johanan son of Kareah and Jezaniah son of Hoshea, and all the people from the least to the greatest, approached, guess who? Jeremiah the prophet, and said to him, "Please, hear our petition and pray to the Lord your God for this entire remnant. For as you now see, though we were once many, now only a few are left. Pray that the Lord your God will tell us where we should go and what we should do." Now, this is interesting. Now, remember, you feel sorry for these people. They're the remnant. Their king is gone. Their king is dead. They're the poor people left behind. But just because you're a poor person doesn't mean you're, you know, a righteous person. Just because you're not the king of Judah doesn't mean you're, you know, a righteous person. So these people, they're part of the same culture that was in rebellion. And they say, "Would you please ask the Lord what we should do?" Verse 4. "I have heard you," replied Jeremiah the prophet. "I will certainly pray to the Lord your God as you have requested. I will tell you everything the Lord says and will keep nothing back from you." And they said to Jeremiah, "May the Lord be true and faithful witness against us if we do not act in accordance with everything the Lord your God sends you to tell us." Now, are you listening to this? We want you to, they're going to Jeremiah because Jeremiah's never been wrong. Everything he says takes place. And now these people rejected him along with many other people. But now we have nowhere to go. We need you to help us. You're the only one left. He says, "Okay, I will." And they say, "We will do whatever the Lord sends for us to do. Whether it is favorable or unfavorable, we will obey the Lord our God, to whom we are sending you, so that it will go well with us, for we will obey the Lord our God." Now this sounds like some other group that you may remember. The people of Israel standing at the base of Mount Sinai when they say, "Here's the law of Moses. Yes, we will do everything written in the law. Are you sure you want to sign the contract?" "Yes, we will do our part." You know, it's not the Abrahamic covenant. All you got to do is believe. You got to actually act on this. So they're saying the same thing. Okay, 10 days later, verse 7. 10 days later, the word of the Lord came to Jeremiah. So he called together Johanan, son of Kareah, and all the army officers who were with him, and all the people from the least to the greatest. Everyone's there. This is what's left of Israel. This is what is left of Israel. He said to them, "This is what the Lord, the God of Israel, to whom you sent me to present your petition, says." Now, quote, here's God speaking. "If you stay in this land, I will build you up and not tear you down. I will plant you and not uproot you, for I am grieved over the disaster I have inflicted on you." Now remember how the book of Jeremiah begins. "I've sent you to tear down and build up, to uproot and to plant." Well, Jeremiah's side of his prophecy is saying the uprooting and the tearing down has taken place. Now it's time to begin the what? The planting and the restoring. And God says now it's time to do the planting. And you are the ones I'll begin with. Now ultimately, because of their behavior, The planting is going to be those who come back from exile in 538 after Cyrus's release in 539. But he says, I am grieved over the disaster I've inflicted on you. Now, again, that doesn't mean he says, I made a mistake, I overreacted, I lost my temper. No, I mean, you don't lose your temper for a matter of 40 years. I mean, he'd been saying it for 40 years. He's grieved he had to do it. He's grieved that this is the condition they are in. He wanted to build them up. But he says, do not be afraid of the king of Babylon who you now fear. They're running from Nebuchadnezzar. He says, don't be afraid of Nebuchadnezzar. And God can say that confidently because God is the one who put Nebuchadnezzar in this position. He's the one who says, Nebuchadnezzar is coming to destroy you because I'm going to bring him. And I can tell you now, he's not coming back. He's not coming back. How are you sure? Yeah, because I'm the one who made him come the first time. I'm the one who put him on the throne. I know he's not coming back. Do not be afraid of him, declares the Lord, for I am with you and will save you and deliver you from his hands. I will show you compassion so that he will have compassion on you and restore you to your land. In other words, he's telling you, he will understand your side of the story. He'll understand what took place and he'll feel sorry for you. He'll appoint someone else and we'll get this thing back on track. That's the good news. Verse 13, however, if you say, we will not stay in this land, and so disobey the Lord your God. And if you say, no, we will go and live in Egypt, where we will not see war or hear the trumpet or be hungry for bread. Notice, will not see war, will not hear the trumpet, which is the war cry, and will not be hungry for bread. We're going to go to Egypt where there's peace and there's plenty. Now, what's like comical is there's one place Nebuchadnezzar has not attacked yet and been successful, and that's Egypt, and that's next on the list. So if you want to run there, do not think. Just because they've got peace right now doesn't mean they're going to have peace in the next 10, 15 years. Because Nebuchadnezzar is heading there next. Then hear the word of the Lord, O remnant of Judah. This is what the Lord Almighty, the God of Israel, says. If you are determined to go to Egypt and you do go to settle there, then the sword you fear will overtake you there, and the famine you dread will follow you into Egypt, and there you will die. Indeed, all who are determined to go to Egypt will settle there, will die by the sword, famine, and plague, and not one of them will survive or escape the disaster I will bring on them. This is what the Lord Almighty, the God of Israel, says. As my anger and wrath have been poured out on those who lived in Jerusalem, so will my wrath be poured out on you when you go to Egypt. You will be the object of cursing and horror and condemnation and reproach. You will never see this place again. Well, now that's a pretty clear answer. You stay here, it's going to be fine. Nebuchadnezzar will work through it. You'll prosper. I'm going to plant you and grow you. You will be fine. But if you go here, do not misunderstand. You will be destroyed. You will be cursed. I will hunt you down and you'll die by the plague, the sword, the famine. You don't want to go there. Verse 19, O remnant of Judah, the Lord has told you. Now this is Jeremiah now interpreting it in case they missed it. The Lord has told you, do not go to Egypt. Be sure of this. I warn you today that you made it a fatal mistake when you sent me to the Lord your God and said. He's, I'm telling you right now, when you told me to pray and ask God and you told me, pray to the Lord our God for us, tell us everything he says and we will do it. That was a fatal mistake. Because you won't do it. I have told you today, but you still have not obeyed the Lord your God in all he sent me to tell you. And it's been 40 plus years. So now, be sure of this. You will die by the sword, famine, and plague in the place where you want to go to settle. Now again, Jeremiah, it's not like, well, can we trust Jeremiah? I mean, just look at what, the whole book. It's just like clockwork. Verse 40, I mean, you see, it's a matter of people's hearts. And you wonder, if you're in that condition, if you're in this situation, what would you do? Would you be, yeah, me and Jeremiah are staying here? It's like, or of the political culture right there, would you run down to Egypt also? Chapter 43, 802. I better quit. I'm going to just read a little bit here. Just when Jeremiah finished telling the people all the words of the Lord, their God, everything the Lord had sent him to tell them, Azariah, son of Hoshea, and Johanan, son of Kareah, all the arrogant men said to Jeremiah, you are lying. The Lord our God has not sent you to say you must not go to Egypt to settle there, but Baruch, son of Neriah, is inciting you against us. Your scribe, Baruch, who's still alive, remember God promised him, if you stay bold, you'll be fine. He's inciting you against us to hand us over to the Babylonians. Your plan is to hand us over to Nebuchadnezzar. Somehow you're getting a cut of the deal here. No, you're a Babylon, the Babylonian side. Let's get out of here. It's like, oh. And the part, if you read on here, we'll pick this up next week, chapter 43. Didn't get as far as I wanted to tonight again. There's a map. I handed you a map to kind of show you some of the details where they're heading. The thing is, they take Jeremiah with them. They take Jeremiah with them. Jeremiah doesn't even get to stay in the land. The Nebuchadnezzar says, go wherever you want to go. Jeremiah said, well, I'm going to stay here and serve the people. And then they take him to Egypt. And then apparently he dies in Egypt. Some legends say that he gets stoned in Egypt. I like, but see, they're going to be alive when Nebuchadnezzar comes. Nebuchadnezzar is going to attack them, and Jeremiah is going to go down there and prophesy to them. He's got some great prophecies here coming yet. I like to think, and this is not supported anyway but my own emotional connection. I like to think that Nebuchadnezzar came and attacked, set his throne up right where Jeremiah says he's going to set his throne up. He came, Jeremiah marked it. He lifted up some pavement stones and put a rock there and then covered it back up. And he says, what are you doing? I'm putting a stone right here under the pavement because right here is where Nebuchadnezzar is going to set his throne up here in Egypt when he comes here and destroys this place. Oh, you're crazy. Well, a few weeks later, here comes Nebuchadnezzar, destroys the place, sets his throne right up there and begins giving orders in the land. I like to think that Jeremiah wasn't stoned to death, but Nebuchadnezzar found him as an older man yet, a few years older, and says, this time you're coming back with me. And I'd like to think that he took him back to Babylon. There's no historical proof of this. It's, like I said, my own emotional connection. And him and Daniel got to have Bible studies, Jeremiah's final days there in the palace. And that's why Daniel later says, I was reading in the scroll of Jeremiah. He got a personal hand copy handed to him by Jeremiah himself. There's no historical proof of that. There's no biblical. There's not even a mystical vision to go with that. It's just that's what I want to believe. But yeah, exactly. I like that ending better. So anyway, we'll pick this up next week. Thank you for your patience. Thank you for being here. Father, we do thank you again for your truth. We thank you for your word. And we do ask that we may again learn from it, that we would grow from it, that we'd be conformed in the image of Christ, that we may live a life that is pleasing to you at this time in history. Father, again, thank you for this opportunity. We thank you for our freedom. And we do seek and ask revival for our own land. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.